Okay, so I'm going to read it a bit slowly so you can get it. I think it has to be paid a lot of attention to. So it's called grammatical sabotage.
I'm here.
Okay, good. So this is grammar, you know, grammatical, but he has it matrical. Maybe that's matrix, I don't know. No, that's before the matrix. Grammatical sabotage. The subtitle is Conversing with Frank Zappa's Thingfish. So part one starts off, ow, O-W exclamation mark. One of the characteristics of Zappa's lyric writing is a theory of excess that results in dramatic and often criticized verbal confrontations. These confrontations occur on both formal and contentual content levels. Whoever typing, mute. I don't want to hear the typing.
All right.
Yeah. These confrontations occur on both formal and contentual levels. Formally, that means in formalities, formalistically, not previously, but dealing with form. Formally, an abundance of multiple entendres, generosity towards slang, and a severely parodic nature provide a linguistic framework guaranteed to make the avid academic shudder in the shoes. So he's describing, I guess, what Zappa did, the forms. Contentually, no subject is spared, not even Zappa. In brackets, as evidenced by the reworking of the torture never stops into the torchum, T-O-R-C-H-U-M, never stops. Footnote 2. So I forgot to do footnote 1, which says, it just identifies the cast and characters of Thingfish. So in footnote number 2, The Torture Never Stops was first released on Zoo Dolores, 1976. The only other legitimate variation occurs on the double CD, You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore, Volume 1, and its final companion, You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore, Zap Fergus, 1988. A live recording with extra bridge work from Nuremberg, 1977. That's The Torture Never Stops. But The Torture...
I like that song.
Right. The Torchum Never Stops, musically similar, is vastly different lyrically as a result of its place in Thingfish's narrative and the minor changes made to accommodate that contextual shift. The primary difference between the two versions is the addition of the evil prince's monologue, in brackets, to cheesy piano accompaniment, before the last verse. Monologues before the last verse. Then you got to get down to footnote 35. Says the monologue shows up again as the evil prince on You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore sampler, a richly orchestrated live performance from Vancouver, December 18th, 1984. So back to the essay. This spirit of excess ordinarily manifests itself in controlled doses. Now let's say the tech body is what he's describing here as Thingfish. We're witnessing excess now with Puppy Daddy and everything else. The spirit of excess ordinarily manifests itself in controlled doses, ranging from, say, the incidental, help me, in Billy the Mountain, tonally quoted from the film The Fly, to the flagrant conclusion of Evelyn, a Modified Dog. So footnote 4 on The Fly says, The Fly, 1958, screenplay by James Clavell, very close to Richard Clavell, remediating McLuhan, directed by Kurt Newman, starring Al Hedison, Greg, you might know all these people, Patricia Owens, and Vince Price. Remade in 1987 with screenplay by director David Cronenberg, starring Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum. Now, Gina Davis disappeared pretty quickly. She probably had some integrity. The powerful help me scene was ignored. One of the few points where this film intersects with the original story by George Langoland. In Langland's the fly is lost, all but momentarily, and no help me's occur. Andre able to emit only a strange metallic sigh. Andre, is that, no, who that is? The only sound we hear from either mutation, a strange metallic sigh. So the modified dog, 1975, released in the old master's box, also late 80s. Lyrics from Evelyn. Evelyn, a dog, having undergone further modification, pondered the significance of short person behavior. See, that's like Will Smith and his son. In pedal depressed panchromatic resonance and other highly ambient domains. So it sounds like Puffy's scene is very ambient, right? Evelyn, the dog, says, arf, arf, she said. In Thinfish, however, subtlety in all its forms is tossed out the window in favor of all-out extravagance. Thinkfish is, perhaps unarguably, the most lyrically excessive title Zappa has released to date. Its excesses could very well have engendered reviews such as the one proposed by its evil prince. So its excesses encourage reviews like the following, which seems to come in Torture Never Stops, the monologue What Happened to Broadway. The evil prince does that monologue, and here's the words he says, which could be applied to Thinkfish. I'll say it's disgusting, atrocious, and dull. I'll say it makes boils inside of your skull. I'll say it's the worst of the year. No wind down the plane, and it's hard on your ear. I'll say it's a work of an infantile mind. I'll say that it's tasteless, and that you will find a better excuse to spend money or time at a Tupperware party. So then Curry writes, the evil prince's rant, in brackets, a special review I've been saving for years for a show just like this. So what I just said was saved by the evil prince sort of vent. The evil prince's rant summarizes quite accurately what most listeners' responses will be like after a surface listen. In brackets, though dull doesn't strike me as appropriate. I confess that my first few listens, says J.W. Curry, failed to intrigue me beyond an interest in the dialect constructed for Thinkfish, the character narrator, and the recontextualization of songs lifted from other albums. 8 of the 22 songs in quotes, have appeared elsewhere in variant versions. Footnote 7, he lists all the fucking songs. We don't do that. Repeated listenings, though, have me convinced that Thinkfish is a piece crucial to any attempt at arriving at any conclusions about Zappa's work. While the material may be slightly less musically complex than his other 1984 releases, Zem or Us and The Perfect Stranger, he says Zem or Us is mainly an electric orientation with emphases on seamless vocal harmonies and complex instrumental virtuosity. And in Stranger, The Perfect Stranger, Boulez, this is scored for chamber orchestra and performed by Pierre Boulez Ensemble in Contemporain. The other half is electronic and electroacoustic music performed by Zappa's Barking Pumpkin Digital Gratification Consort. Oh, but then you got footnote 6. What happened to Broadway, Evil Prince? Okay. So while the material may be slightly less musically complex than his other 1984 releases, lyrically, it's a highly sophisticated web of referentiality that manages, despite its endlessness of tangents and occupation of several simultaneous time zones, to tell a story. So even while the material may be less musically, a web of referentiality that manages to tell a story. So that's under OW. So first listening to the album hurts, even for someone who goes to like it, and then finds great significance in it. Part 2, the story. Thinkfish is at base a Broadway musical within a Broadway musical. Harry and Rhonda, an entirely superficial couple, go to the theater to take in some, quote, real Broadway entertainment, unquote. The curtain opens to reveal the narrator, Thinkfish, a male Aunt Jemima with a huge potato head, talking shoes, and incomprehensible duck lips. Thinkfish gives an account of the story so far, introduces the cast of Mammy Nuns that encourages them to piss all over the front row, driving away the first nighters, leaving only Harry and Rhonda, unwilling to leave at these ticket prices. at these ticket prices, in quotes. Harry and Rhonda then take part in an enforced audience participation as the story takes us on a ride of governmental atrocity, colon. So here's the atrocity. The systematic genocidal removalance of homosexuals and severely tanned individuals from the American way of life. Footnote 10. AWOL. AWOL, what's that? From individuals, I guess they remove them, and it's called American way of life is AWOL. You know, military things, you have some without leave. So the American way of life stands for AWOL. A plan lorded over by the evil prince. Now that's what Ian says is coming to Americans. Along the way, we visit all manner of uniquely American locales. The Mud Club, a new wave dance dive. The Quentin Robert De Nameland Video Chapel of Economic Worship. The Aladdin Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. The Hawaiian Lunch Truck Stop. A cardboard nativity box on an unknown Italian's front lawn somewhere in New Jersey. Footnote 11. The unknown Italian is revealed as Francesco in the libretto. In Zappa's Demarest, the book, he is further identified as Francesco Zappa, the unknown Italian composer who lived from, he lived longer, but he was active in the same years as Frank Zappa, 1763 to 1788, who plays a major part in Demarest. But you have to go to footnote 47. Describes the Demarest thing. No. North Hollywood, Barking Public Press. Thingfish, the book, I guess, comprises chapters 9 to 11 of Them or Us. And the description of Them or Us is, this cheesy little homemade book was prepared for the amusement of people who already enjoy Zappa music. It is not for intellectuals or other dead people. It is designed to answer one of the more troubling questions related to conceptual continuity. Quote, how do all these things that don't have anything to do with each other fit together, forming a larger absurdity? So back to the essay. So truck stops, cardboard nativity box, an unknown Italian's front lawn somewhere in New Jersey, and repeatedly on Broadway. As the story progresses, the characters regress even further from reality than they already are. Harry becomes a cretinously costumed joy boy, drooling over the Mammy Nun's sister, Abdullah X, and his tiny mandolin. So he is Harry, the sophisticated New Yorker, is drooling over one of the Mammy Nuns. While Harry, as a boy, plukes artificial Rhonda. His wife is Rhonda, but he plukes the artificial one. Now think of the puffy scenes. A blow-up plastic replica of the real Rhonda. Is artificial Rhonda. Herself revealed as the hopeless militant feminist she thinks she is. The evil prince, as a result of a detrimental diet, mutates into a mammy nun himself. The closing scene finds everyone living down to their potential, typical Broadway pomp. Footnote 12. So then he quotes from the libretto. The mammies dance tangos, this is, I guess, at the end. The mammies dance tangos with the zombies, which were organized by another guy. The zombies were organized by the evil prince. He's got his dance troupe, and Thingfish has the mammies. The mammies dance tangos with the zombies, eventually hurling them off stage. The evil prince cornholes Rhonda, the adult real Rhonda, who doesn't even notice as she waves her magic wand fountain pen, waves it around for Harry to follow. He's trying to get Harry back to her. Thingfish snatches up the crabgrass baby, which is this thing that's in this Christmas decoration on the New Jersey front lawn. Nativity scene. Snatches up the crabgrass baby and Abdullah, one at each hand, shaking them like maracas, while twirl dancing around the yard. Harry, as a boy, and the artificial Rhonda reappear, chasing after the infant, the crabgrass baby, Quentin Robert de Mainland. I think he runs the School of Appliantology. So he's L. Ron Hubbard. Quentin Robert de Mainland, Cornhole's Brown Moses. Opal rides the bull while Francesco gives her an enema. Francesco from 1700s. The nativity box rotates erratically, delivering Dutch midgets who offer onions to the audience. The scene, now Curry says, the scene is so excessively bad, only the onions can save the day. So then, from a monologue by Zappa occurring at the end of Packard Goose, the lyrics of which open, maybe you thought I was the Packard Goose or the Ronald McDonald of the Nouveau Abstruse. So fuck all them people. I don't need no excuse for being what I am. Footnote 49. While Packard Goose first appeared in Joe's Garage Act 3, the monologue version referred to here appeared on Show and Tell, a bootleg of live and radio material around 1973, issued singly and in 20 years of Frank Zappa, a 12-record box collection of bootleg material compiled by Ferdinand Durst and itself. And compiled by Ferdinand Durst and itself reissued numerous times, apparently often accompanied by a book. My copy of 20 Years of Frank Zappa was given to me by Matt Groening. Okay. I also have a poster here of Captain Beefheart paintings at Olympia College, where Mark was interested in visiting, Evergreen College in Olympia, Washington. And the poster is Beefheart paintings and Cal Schenkel. That was organized, I think, that gallery exhibit in Olympia was organized by Matt Groening, and he gave me the poster, which I still have, 50 years later. 50 years, turning it around. So in the footnotes, 13, from Packard Goose, this is sort of a weird, I think this is Zinkfish. I don't know who's saying this. If it's Zappa, all right. It's titled Zappa's Thing for Fish. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to fantasize along with me this evening that in some small way, the process of performing the show will rid you of your own personal demon. Whatever it is, that's just bothering the shit out of you this year. That's relevant. So it's an exorcism. Just, you know what I mean? Just, you know what I mean? Because you guys in New York should know more than anybody else in the world that the only way that you're ever going to make it through life without going completely crazy is by finding someone or something to say, fuck you, also. You gotta find someone to say, fuck you with to everybody else. And then Zappa says, see? Question, see? Now, in the past, many governments and religious leaders have paraphrased that expression in such a way as to make a certain religious or political or ethnic minority the victim of their cruel disregard. But today, it's the time for the people who have been the victims of that cruel disregard to turn around and disregard something else. So have a good time. So that's a little side thing from Zappa. I guess on the album. The monologue at the end of Packard Goose. Okay, so now J. W. Curry says, the entire cast of Thingfish practices this disregard. Now, that's interesting. You know, Zappa, when he first got interviewed in Hit Parader in 1967, he told the kids to say, I doubt it, to anything anybody says to you. Parents, teachers, friends, I doubt it. So this is an update 20 years later where he's getting people to say, fuck you, and find another person to do it with. So Thingfish is practicing doing this. I mean, the entire cast of Thingfish. The entire cast, I think, has practiced this disregard with absolute relish, but none with quite so much aplomb as Thingfish himself. These levels of disregard exist within the boundaries of the musical, but they're also engendered beyond those boundaries. That is, the primary audience contained in the play, and the rest of the cast, displays its attitudinal baggage, and we, the secondary audience, are provoked into similar immediate reactions. By building an audience into the work, our attention, so Frank brings the audience into the work, our attention is neatly diverted from linear plot to an awareness of the elaborate polysynchronic structure, which due to the musical necessity of elapsed time, is subverted back into an altered form of narrative. So due to the musical necessity of elapsed time, we're talking about no time, is subverted back into an altered form of narrative. This paradox of the linear as vehicle for the nonlinear is but one of an abundance of devices used to challenge the listener's disregard. What was he saying? The cast practices doing disregard. So Zappa said his big concern about is what time it is. So the time theme comes in here, and he's trying to show you something nonlinear by a linear vehicle. That's all he's got. The mind, linear. So I hadn't read this before. Again, this syncs up with many of our themes today. So Julian Kobeck, author of Zappa, A Biography, has the following perceptions to offer on Thingfish. Footnote 14 says, he wrote the book in 1987. So Kobeck wrote, 1984 saw the release not only of The Perfect Stranger and Them or Us, but also a book, Them or Us, and a box set of records for a musical comedy entitled Thingfish. Many of the basic tracks for the latter, Thingfish, had been recorded back the previous year. So there's going to be a couple. There's that statement by Kobeck. Then Curry says, this is very characteristic of the reactions to Thingfish. Begrudged admission of its existence, but little regard for what it is. But little regard for what it is that is existing. Not so dissimilar from the general reactions of Zappa himself. And I would say J.W. Curry encourages that towards him. So it's going to be a projection here. Not so dissimilar from the general reactions of Zappa himself. And we begrudgingly admit of his existence, but we have little regard for what he does. Faced with this prevalent attitude, why not hand out at least a few deserved fuck yous? Says J.W. Curry. Thingfish represents not a few, but an endless stream of fuck yous, varying in intensity from mild linguistic jests, in brackets, hound them mercilessly. What's that? Footnote 15. Spoken by Rhonda in the song called The Massive Improver Limps. Hound them mercilessly to outright spite. So Thingfish represents not a few, but an endless stream of fuck yous, varying in intensity from mild linguistic jests like hound them mercilessly to outright spite. And here's the spite. The ensemble, the mammies and cast, they say, eat that pork, eat that ham, laugh till you choke on Billy Graham. So Curry says, a fine rhyme for a very poor fish. So that's section 3 called Zappa's Thing for Fish. Right, we were talking about fish today. Hey, the wisdom. Salmon wisdom. What do you think of that, Trey? Fits right in here. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fish fucking thing. All right. Okay, so, to become enlightened today, to get detachment of your surrounding environment, it's come to the point where you have to say fuck you a lot to everything. You just can't go around saying a mantra or...
Yeah.
Doing yoga on a yoga mat, you're up against the the tech body, for fuck's sake. So this is prophetic, for fuck's sake. It's where you have to be today. Whew. This is wise fish here from Frank. Talk about being prophetic. Part four. Rhythmic, R-H-Y-M-E, rhyme, the mic, T-H-M-I-C. Rhythmic, permuseceptacles. So these are Curry's words. Permu, not receptacles, permuseceptacles. So he says, think this, superbly voiced, is a contemporary George Kingfish Stevens of the Amos and Andy Show, 17. A comedy show begun in 1928 by Charles Correll and Freeman Godson as a radio version of The Gumps. 50, what's The Gumps? A comic strip devised in 1917 by Joseph Patterson, written and drawn by Sidney Smith and later by Gus Edson, retaining Smith's crudity, featuring Annie and Minnie Dump. Dump was Joseph Patterson, 1917's, his word for idiot. So, I guess it's Mr. and Mrs. Gump. Back to footnote 17. So, a radio version of The Gumps. The Gumps became Sam and Henry, and as a result of a network change a short while later, Amos and Andy. Sometime in the 50s, a television version with Tim Moore as Kingfish was aired. Moore's Kingfish is apparently the model for Ike Willis's Thinkfish. So I heard something. Read the Wikipedia on Tim Moore. He was a black actor who got screwed over a lot. Then he became super famous as Kingfish in the 50s television version. So huge, it was like today. The guy had to hide. He was so harassed. Then all of a sudden they found a scandal about him. I think the blacks started complaining this is a satire on black people or something. So I'm not sure. So he immediately got dropped, lost everything, money, family, and became homeless, was cared for, and died a couple of years later. So that's what's happening to a lot of your stars today after they go to Puff Daddy. They don't sing along. They get fucking canned. So maybe that's where the canceling all started from. The results of party. What do you call it? The outcome of parties. The side effects of the party. So Zappa's showing this abuse, Croker's abuse value is an economic term, in 1982 and 1984. After he found out about AIDS, his neighbor had helped make AIDS, and he had to change it a bit. So Thinkfish, superbly voiced, is a contemporary George Kingfish Stevens of the Amos and Andy Show, elevated to the position of host with intent. He's a host with intent. Since his position of subversive narrator is primarily linguistic, he does have actions to perform, but these are predominantly attached to his narratival activities, in brackets, as well as only exposed in the accompanying libretto. Narrative of other attached to his activities, which you can only learn about in the libretto. Since his position is linguistic, the subversion is therefore primarily exposed through formal deviations from acceptable speech patterns. And he quotes Zappa saying, from the Real Frank Zappa book, 1989, Zappa says, one of the things I've said before in interviews is, quote, without deviation from the norm, progress is not possible. In order for one to deviate successfully, one has to have at least a passing acquaintance with whatever norm one expects to deviate from. So he quotes Zappa saying that. Then Curry says, the common denominators in all characters' deviations are mispronunciation. And they have the mispronunciation of syphilis with a Z, syphilis, spoken in the prelude. So deviations are mispronunciation, mispre and suffixation, putting pre and suffixes after in the middle of strange words, like preformance for performance, preformance 20, spoken by the evil prince in the song Drop Dead. Much of this miscontextualization is invisible to the casual viewer because of a tendency to stick to following the surface narrative as a linear route of suggestion indicative of the author's immutable view. The author's view, though, is as mercurial as our own subjective fictions, you know, like Finney's Wake. In this respect, individual words and phrases can be isolated from the narrative as narratives in themselves. Documentaries, they can be documentaries of the interreferencing inherent. Documentaries of the interreferencing inherent in the context the word or phrase exists within. So that's Finneganese. Then there's footnote. What is this? I think this is from the book or the original cast recording. Where Zappa says, Curry's quoting Zappa. Songs written with one idea in mind have been known to mutate into something completely different if I hear an optional vocal inflection during rehearsal. He's explaining how he'll change songs because of some slight change that only his ear can pick up. I'll hear a hint of something, often a mistake, and pursue it to its most absurd extreme. The technical expression we use in the band to describe this process is putting the eyebrows on it. This usually refers to vocal parts, although you can put the eyebrows on just about anything. After the eyebrows, the ultimate tweeze inflicted on the composition is determining the attitude with which the piece is to be performed. The player is expected to comprehend the attitude and perform the material with the attitude and the eyebrows consistently. Otherwise, to me, the piece sounds wrong. To Zappa, it'll sound wrong otherwise. Since most Americans use a personal version of eyebrows-ish, in their conversational speech, why not include the technique as a nuance in a composition? Well, that's a pretty interesting statement, eh? For you grammarians. So then Curry says, since Thingfish is essentially a Broadway show, this catalog of reference extends to include the visual as well. Thus, Rhonda is exuding to her Harry, who's ignoring her, I'm going to put my glasses on, Harry. I'm going to put my hair up in a bun. Then I'm going, fuck, 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 ha, 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 look. And she fucks the briefcase during the briefcase boogie. And there's a picture. All these pictures were in Hustler magazine in 1984, a lot of these images. So then Curry says, there are visualizational instructions scattered throughout the libretto. But if you, like me, ordinarily listen to music as a simultaneous focus during some other mundane activities, the libretto is not likely to be turning its own pages as it hovers at eye level in front of you. The image forms from oral stimuli. There is certainly no lack of leaping points. So what he's saying there, scatter throughout the libretto if you like, ordinarily listen to music as simultaneous focus. Background is not likely to be turning its own pages. So it's a big distraction, so you probably don't look at the libretto. Your image forms from oral stimuli, from what you hear. There's certainly no lack of leaping points. Leaping, I don't know, in error or what? The lyrics of Thingfish are very articulate in their misconstructions. During a vocal fill between bars in the Mammy Nun song, what sounds like boo man in him, Human inya, resolves on closer inspection to whom a ninny? Him? Him a ninny? Ha! Whom a ninny? You're a ninny? Ha! The two lines are conversationally inflectional tonally. And that's the word that he has in brackets that Zappa uses. Sprechstimme. You know, German meaning talking song. The two lines are conversationally inflectional tonally. Rhythmically percussive, timingly, in brackets, sound poetry. The two lines are conversationally inflectional tonally, so I guess that's the talking, sprechstimme, but rhythmically percussive, timingly, that's sound poetry that J.W. Curry is a fan of. So he was primely skilled and trained to figure out what's going on in thinkish. So then he quotes from the real Frank Zappa book. Zappa says, if a musical point can be made in a more entertaining way by saying a word than by singing a word, the spoken word will win out in the arrangement, unless a non-word or a mouth noise gets the point across faster. So then he has here, in the Crabgrass Baby song, he then quotes from the libretto, says, we hear a slow dirge over which the mammies chant a twisted variation of the syllables being sung by a computer-generated voice. He had just gotten his Sinclair there. The richly human melody sets an eerily continuous background for the Crabgrass Baby's first scat phoneticizations to blip across. The richly human melody sets an eerily continuous background for the Crabgrass Baby's first scat phoneticization to blip across. These resolve into a series of puerilized, infantilized borrowings from the text elsewhere in Thinkish, mixed with clippings from Lumpy Gravy and the already puerile Valley Girl. So he has the footnotes for people who don't know. He explains the two versions of We're On for the Money and Lumpy Gravy, and segments of Motorhead Sherwood's monologues have been adapted in a very agile manner, says Curry. And Valley Girl by Frank and Moon and Zappa released as a single in 1982 on the album Ship Arriving Too Late to Save a Drowning Week. So then Curry says, the grammatical systems subjected to mutation are those of both language and music. The two notational devices mutually effective, that's affective, in their varying from the norm. An idiosyncrasy applied to one system results in alterations of the other in order to accommodate the change in a sympathetic manner. So I'll read that again. The grammatical systems subjected to mutation are those of both language and music. The two notational devices mutually effective in their varying from the norm. An idiosyncrasy applied to one system results in alterations of the other in order to accommodate the change in a sympathetic manner. So this has turned out to be a very good description of the subtleties of Zappa's composition that nobody notices. What do you think of that, Brian? Oh, Brian's on mute. What do you think of that, Brian?
That is fair to say. That is true.
And it's cleverly spelled out, accurately spelled out, which I don't see anybody else doing. Now, this gives us a clue, though. Aha! This gives us a clue to what Don Thiel is writing in that complex essay about fitting his wake. And what McLuhan saw. So this helps us understand the Fitting His Wake Thiel article. Again, we brought that up. See? This is as amazing as Ion, the way these shows go. Ion doing Joyce. Okay, so he finds meaning that's obviously hidden. We find meaning that becomes obvious as the show unfolds. How's that? You're here to witness that, Trey. Make your notes.
Mm-hmm.
So then
we circle back to we're able to call back to
what
we
said.
Yeah.
What
we
channeled.
To the early themes.
Yeah. That we didn't know were coming. What was it? You played the music. And what did I notice about the music or something? At the beginning? I made a comment about the rarity of it, but then it turned out it wasn't rare. There were some of them were hits, but there was something about the
Talked about the Charles Manson.
Yeah, the Manson thing. So you pick songs often based on the week's news, right?
Greg has been doing that more.
I will
sometimes pick some one or two, but I usually pick some stuff I was listening to as well or something.
Well, didn't you pick a Baby Oil, or those were both Greg's?
Those were Greg's.
Oh, okay. So, from the book, Frank's have a book, Frank's going to explain something here. He says, there's an assortment of stock modules. Now, McLuhan talks about Joyce doing verbal modules in Finney's Wake. So Frank is calling them stock modules. There's an assortment of stock modules used in our stage arrangements. Remember, before every show, as I go out the door to enter onto the stage, he says, take no prisoners. So he says, it helps if the guys in the band appreciate the musical humor of what's going on. Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. If a guy can't willingly put on the lampshade and play stooge rock, he's probably wrong for the job. George Duke barely passed that test when he first had to do doo-wop for Frank in 1970, being a jazz guy. Then he says, now these are like conceptual continuity. These stock modules include the Twilight Zone texture, in brackets, which may not be the actual Twilight Zone notes, but the same texture. Another one is the Mr. Rogers texture. A third one, the Jaws texture. And then the Lester Lannan texture. Who's that, Lester Lannan? Anybody know? And then a Jan Garberism. Steve and I used to have a jazz free performer. You know, extreme free. Just fucking plunking. Lloyd Garber. In Toronto today. Look him up, Brian. So this is Jan Garberism. And things that sound either exactly like or very similar to Louie Louie. So, can somebody look up Lester Lannan? L-A-N-I-N? Lester Lannan. American musician. 1907. Geez, he lived to 97 years old. The Lester Lannan Orchestra, the gold standard of live music. He's an American jazz and pop music band leader. He was famous for long, smoothly arranged medleys at a consistent rhythm and tempo, which were designed for continuous dancing. Isn't that what Greg played today? He played some Burt Bacharach type of song. I don't know what it was. Slowly, smoothly arranged medley. His popularity began in the late 1920s, and its popularity increased through the advent of the LP era. So there's Frank showing his obscure musicologist knowledge, right? Musicology. So he says, these various people, Twilight Zone, Mr. Rogers, Jaws, Lester Lannan, Jan Garber, those are archetypal American musical icons. And their presence in an arrangement puts a spin on any lyric in their vicinity. When present, these modules suggest in quotes, these modules suggest that you interpret those lyrics within parentheses. So, this is pretty good stuff for Mr. Curry. No wonder he couldn't take Civilization. So Curry says, all characters, we're coming near the end, all characters in Thingfish are analogous to sociologically parenthesized speech patterns. Mm. The characters are analogous. Their manipulations are clearly demonstrated by the evil prince's fall from pestilential verbosity, see his review of Thingfish above, to a slipshod vernacular. So he's decomposing. So he goes, he starts talking like, remember, he turns into a mammy. So he's going, showing up, You a wise old mammy. Where are you from? Originally. Thingfish says, why? St. Loomis. That's because Ike Willis was from St. Louis. Evil Prince. God damn, I knew it. I knew it. I could just make it out from your renunciation. We hear someone snoring. Is the cat snoring? Probably Greg, eh? Or it's Bridgeton. Who's in Bridgeton? Is that Drew Herbsman? Bridgeton! I don't know who that is, so I'll mute that.
Yeah, it's not the cat this time. The cat. Yeah. The cat sounds like this. You're eating.
Okay. So the evil prince is showing his devolution from pestilential verbosity to slipshod vernacular, the vernacular of Stingfish. So the characters are analogous to sociologically parentized speech patterns. So, you know, his speech pattern illustrates his character, the downfall of evil prince. So then Curry says, within the characterizationally archetypal linguistic context established in Thingfish, and given the grammatical accuracy of the stage directions, of the staging directions, it is the manipulation of both conventional and argotic, A-R-G-O-T-I-C, that's Argo. It is the manipulation of both conventional and, say, local language, which exposes the intrigues lurking as subtext. The intrigues lurking as subtext. Every possible absurdity is readable into or out of the text. It is a matter of multiple exposures going both ways, from text to reader, reader to text. The more the exchange, the more the change to mime and reader. So, as apt as ESP starts to mime your reactions as the audience. And this is what happens at Puffy Daddy's parties. Part 5, earbrow, not eyebrow, earbrow, earbrowsage. What was the last one? Eyebrowsage? Did I say eyebrowsage? I said something like that. Eyebrowsage earlier. Okay, ear browsing. Words rarely mean what they purport to on the surface. Who are the brain police, I would say. But he doesn't say that. What happens when words are written for and sometimes from the mouths of others? When characters are created to speak them. When attitudes are constructed to contextualize them. Then Curry says, Zappa is an observer. A funnel with a filter, translating everything that passes through it into music. Thingfish is a stupid show about stupid people doing stupid things for stupid reasons in stupid settings. It is anthropologically intelligent in its evocation of stupidity. It is literarily soluble to a head. It is literarily soluble, I guess you can dig it. It is literarily soluble to a head, not drowning in brain sand. And a patience, unrebellious at repeated antagonism. So putting up with a lot of attacks on you. A patience, unrebellious. So that's Trump. Okay. The density of information consumable from it. Yeah, see, he can't go non-univocal. He says, the density of information consumable from it, I guess from Zappa's presentation, prevents me from even wanting to come to any kind of conclusions about it as a whole. Now, the guy who writes a bio on the internet of Curry, he gets chewed up by someone else saying, leave Curry alone. He doesn't want to be identified as anything. Do not say he's this or that. Well, Curry's actually saying that here. He doesn't want any kind of conclusion stuck on him. And he's projecting it on Frank. So the density of information consumable from it prevents me from even wanting to come to any kind of conclusions about it as a whole. So that means it's manipinzeta. An exercise similar to attempting a brief synopsis of 200 Motels, the movie, not the record. So he found it hard to summarize 200 Motels. A questionable, and 200 Motels is a questionable form of entertainment outside the privacy of one's home. Rather, I'd like to keep it personal and in flux. An extremely thick layering of inferrals my ears can browse through without stricture, without someone else controlling it. Rich on many levels of experience, Pinkfish, calculatedly easy to ignore, is not a work to be ignorant of. That's what I just said about fucking Cabell's book. Don't be ignorant of his book. Then he signs off saying, stupidity has a certain charm. Dash, ignorance does not. Then he has a picture of Uncle Sam burying in a cemetery, ignorance. J.W. Curry, Toronto, 1989. So that was quite a... Now, there's lots of... Now, here's what's funny. There is 28 or so footnotes that I went through, but it actually goes up to 60. So you'd have to read all these footnotes, which are probably just details about records. What'd you say?
Oh, my. That's a lot of footnotes.
Yeah, he's just explaining where a lot of the stuff for newbies who don't know anything about Zappa, where to get stuff, what they are, his products. But he has here 36. What's that? No? I guess these come. Remember, I was reading a footnote, and then it would have a footnote number in it and take you to a later number. That's where these are.
Okay.
Footnote 7 leads to footnote 41. But 36, I don't know where 36 comes from, but he says, he's talking about Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, that story on Apostrophe. So he says, first released on Apostrophe, re-released in the old Masters Box 3 and as part of Apostrophe Overnight Sensation on CD, 1986. The narrative includes four of the five songs occupying side one. So I guess it's part of the script. Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, Nanook Rubs It, St. Alphonse's Pancake Breakfast, and Father Oblivion. A variation of the entire sequence appears in Can't Do It on Stage, Volume 1, under the title Don't Eat the Yellow Snow, recorded live in London, February 18, 1979, with audience member Angus O'Reilly O'Patrick McGinty reading his poetry. I think that is Ben Watson actually reads his poetry. So maybe Frank's making fun of Ben. Angus O'Reilly O'Patrick McGinty reading his poetry. Ben stands up in the pause in the concert and asks Frank if he can read some of his poetry. He's trying to be a poet at that point, 1978 or so. McGinty reading his poetry, which is his contribution to enforce recreation, in quotes, for enforced recreation / audience participation. So Zappa, he forces people to do audience participation. He's satirizing himself by showing it excessively in a Broadway play. An excerpt from Ben Watts' poetry is under the title Nanook Rubs It, and it's on the sampler. Does it make a noise?
I'm just chuckling at Nanook Rubs It.
He's saying the whole thing is enforced recreation. So if someone asks you to pay attention to their performance, you have to say fuck you all the time. So this is Frank saying fuck you to the audience of his works. And also fuck you to everybody else. Now, when Ben Watson attempted to talk to Zappa through ION on September 2nd, 2009, you can look it up in the timeline, ION starts to say that Zappa always tried to piss off his audience. And he got pissed because it kept being popular. And he couldn't generally piss them off. Now, that could be just one half of Frank in his quadrophenia. Don't know about Ion's accuracy. That's very early. That's Ion within 6 months of showing up. But in listening to it again, it's a very accurate distillation of the deeper motivation of Frank, which he might not always unleashed. But Mr. Curry here does a very good job getting that aspect of Frank. The fuck you aspect. So,
yeah.
I'm glad I finally read this just before the war took over. I finally read the most sophisticated things. I could actually use this to help Don Thiel come across. Because it's Finneganese. See?
Oh, yeah. I've had that very strong impression before, and I mentioned it on the show too, although I wasn't sure what piece I was referring to, but definitely that Thing Fish, or this one performance of Thing Fish that you had played years ago on Payday.
I was like,
wow, this is really Finneganese. Like, not only do I really like it, but it's specifically, this is the most Finneganese kind of, you know, weird just audio play I've ever heard.
Right, so here's the big picture. So you got Pound and Elliot and Yeats and Lewis and Joyce, knowing that language is obsolete, talking, moving your lips is obsolete. So they're going to try to form, who are the brain police in that situation? How does the brain police operate? So they each do their own individual epic attempts to go beyond meaning. Remember, Ellie used to say, people say, well, what's this mean? He said, whatever you want it to mean, it's up to you. That meaning on the content level was that important. It was the form. And that was what McClune was emphasizing. So Don Thiel specializes in showing how this is a Finnegan's Wake, how they go beyond speech. And so Pound, in his epic, The Cantos, he doesn't get to syllables. He doesn't get as far as Biden. He's just at the Trump level of half-uttered sentences, okay? There's none of this multilingual crack-up like in every page of Finnegan's Wake. Right down to the letters. He'll have two letters, and that's a standoff between two themes. Each letter means something in that context. So it's smaller than verbal modules. I think McClune just says modules. So Joyce sort of goes further in excess than anybody, and it stands ignored and shunned. But Frank says in 1970, in some obscure quote I'm looking for someday, that music fell behind the other arts. And he meant painting and writing. Now, when Ben Watson asked him about James Joyce, Zappa said, oh, I looked at it one day, a couple of pages, and I said, this guy gets it. But that's Ulysses. He didn't look at Finneas Wake. Did I say Finneas Wake? It was Ulysses, I'm pretty sure. So Ben thought that Frank didn't have any interest in Finneas Wake. But when I talked to Frank through the Evergreens, he talked about Finneas Wake. It was very important. And then I had some conversation with him after about that. So he was into Finneas Wake a little more than people would expect. But he naturally, if he wasn't into Finneas Wake, and this is my point, Brian, is he got to the breakdown of human communication to the smallest points so that the human can maintain what Coker calls their stubborn essence and say, fuck you to reality, and have a space for not being anthropomorphic, or to find a space that is anthropomorphic. This breakdown was natural under global theater conditions, as everything got broken up anyways, and leading to President Biden. So Zappa caught up. He went further than Boulez and the Serialists and the other composers of serious music. He knew to be more excessively ignorant and to put the stupider stuff in there. Go real stupid. That includes doo-wop. Even though, paradoxically, he liked all the stuff. He liked being stupid every now and then, which is partly what Ion said. So I end this presentation before my colleagues that I summed up pretty good what we've learned so far as of September 25th, 2024. I rest my case, which Brian already knew, he claims. And Greg probably did not survive. He's not even awake. Leon got new material for his own parallel operation. Right, Leon?
I liked the phrase, put the lampshade on.
Yeah.
I guess related to this, like, getting stupid or being able to, like,
at a party, friends and colleagues.
Yeah, I mean, it's all, or even on stage or even on a record, but it's great if you can play very well and you have all this, you have great musical skill and you should be taken seriously as a musician, great. But, you know, if you can't put the lampshade on and do this, like, you know, the score calls for being, like, goony and stupid right now. Can you do that? It's like, no, I will not do that. It's like, well, you're in the band, but you don't get it. That's a limit on your musical skill, you know?
Yeah. Frank knows what he's doing. He knows why it has to be in there at that point. So I noticed that Scott Tunis, sometimes these guys have the stupidest costume on, a stupid hat. And I said, that's corny. Why that hat? You can get better one than that. But they probably got the brief by Zappa of the secret stuff, which John Curry has sussed out. And they put on a stupid, goofy-looking hat. To pretend that they're doing theater on purpose. My new take on that. Like some of the musicians, they only did it half-heartedly or had the alibi that they could do it half-heartedly because he's just being a lampshade. He's doing the lampshade in a crude way.
Mm-hmm.
A further embarrassing way. So there's our deep meditation for today. Are you still here, Trey? Did you catch all that? And, you know, Greg, he left. See, Greg doesn't go the whole way. It's going to be tough getting on the boat to Andromeda for him. He didn't go to the stupid stuff. Greg is afraid of being stupid. I think we got a point here. He won't go totally stupid.
Well, I don't know.
He appreciates other people being stupid.
I guess there's a difference between going stupid and like geeking out. I'm just, what came to mind is, I don't know, him getting right into animation and just like giggling a lot and like, look at this. And then like when he just really gets into his favorite topic and is, you know, he gets right. silly, but that's not really is stupid. That, he's not yeah, being stupid then. He's just geeking out.
Yeah. He's being, he's projecting his own personal vision, not caring whether you think he's stupid. He doesn't think he's stupid.
Right.
I don't think Greg knows what is stupid anymore. Probably what we talk about, Ion, that to him is stupid. He always grills people. Why would you buy that thing?
Right.
Why would you buy a $50 recording of Ion? Now, Ion is really good at acting.
Huh?
Yeah. Ion's really good at acting stupid. It actually makes it hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. Important. It's where people are at much of the time.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to say people are stupid. I mean to say, you know, even when you're not stupid, you can't be unstupid 24 hours a day. You know, you need some music time.
Yeah, you need the resonant pause. And I was going to look up the gap. I was going to read something. Oh yeah, I think I'll go get it. The 10 or so incidents of the gap in public legends.